Hello, everybody. You know what I was thinking just now, Baron Vaughn? I was just thinking the more we get together, the happier we'll be. That's what I was thinking.
True. I believe that's the point of therapy.
It's also the point of talking about movies, which is what we're doing here on Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
And hello.
And hello to all of you, to each and every one of you. And before we get into today's show, which we're looking forward to, we have something special to spring on you folks. This Friday, we're dropping a bonus episode.
An interview with a fantastic actor and a fantastic man.
Stephen Tobolowsky.
Indeed.
An experienced, wonderful, working character actor who you've all seen. If you don't know his name, you do know his face.
If you've seen movies, you've seen his face.
Yes, pretty likely. And he's also a great storyteller. And the proof is in the pudding. Check out that episode. We know you're going to enjoy it.
Good podcast today.
Yes, we know it's a good podcast.
We haven't even done it yet, but we know it's going to be good.
We like the films we're talking about. We have things to say. And our subject today, sort of a broad topic.
It's broad, is, yeah.
No pun intended.
Pun intended is what
Well, you intended it. I didn't.
Okay.
But then you're a punny guy.
I am punny, yes. Yeah. A broad topic, and that topic is?
Leading ladies.
Uh-oh.
All right. It's, as I say, a wide-ranging topic, but we picked three films with interesting women in them. First, An Ideal Husband, a film that we like from 1999, with two leading ladies, three actually.
Yes.
Because we're talking about Cate Blanchett, Julianne Moore, and if you're going to count the third, it would be Minnie Driver.
Yes, indeed.
They all have major parts
it's
in this film.
It's an Oscar Wilde play that was adapted to this movie by... is it Oliver?
Oliver Parker.
I was going to say Olivier anytime I see any Britishers now. Oliver Parker, who is a really interesting director.
He is. Well, he wrote the screenplay as well. And then just a year or two later—
He did
The Importance of Being Earnest.
The most famous of Oscar Wilde's plays.
Exactly. With another all-star cast. That one has Rupert Everett, who's in this one as well, and Colin Firth and Reese Witherspoon and Judi Dench. So an A-list gathering in both cases. And he hasn't had as stellar a career since then. I think he's had a harder time getting these kind of movies made.
If I am correct, and I believe I am correct, there is a film that he made way before this one, which is one of the stranger films ever made. Not stranger films ever made. It's Hellraiser.
Yes.
He directed Hellraiser.
He did.
People.
He also did a ghastly adaptation of Dorian Gray. If I can use the term god-awful. It's a god-awful adaptation.
It's a version of Dorian Gray that would make you wish that Pinhead was coming for you.
Oh, man. It starred Ben Barnes and Colin Firth, and I don't wish that on anybody.
I remember it.
But An Ideal Husband,
however,
is a lovely and charming film.
Yes. It's the most British-y of things. I'm like, this is – I could not – that looks exhausting. I was thinking, it's like, I could not be a white person in England at that time period. That looks like it's never-ending stress.
Not only that, I mean, the filming of it, my goodness, it's 1895. It was written in 1895.
Yes.
First performed in 1895 as a play, and the film, in fact, is set in 1895. And right at the beginning, the first few establishing shots are pretty grand.
Yes.
In their scope. All these people in costume and period costume, in period settings, in period locations.
Production design is pretty incredible.
It sure is. I mean, there's, you know, it's flawless.
Yeah.
Is what it is.
He really shows you that era and what these people, what this genteel group of people would be like. And how they would be dressed and what their days would be like all around the context of this story that's unfolding. And like I said, it looks exhausting.
Yes.
Just nonstop baths.
The starchy collars alone.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, if you're a woman, I think corsets would be the operative word. And if you're a man, I think starched collars would be.
Ascots, yes, girdles, all sorts of things.
The works. But it's also about the, not just the mores, but the protocol, maybe that's the word I'm looking for.
Manners.
The protocol of society. Yes.
Manners, yes.
Everything very much according to protocol. The way you address people, the way you deal with people of different stations and in different situations, how one is supposed to respond, how one is supposed to absorb news or information. And of course, there are people who break those rules or bend those rules always, otherwise there would be no drama.
But they're also... so honest about it as they're doing it.
Yeah.
He's like, I am going to break these rules, and here's why, with a clever British thing.
Wow. But well cast.
Yes.
Very well cast up and down the line. Jeremy Northam, very good actor, plays a distinguished young member of Parliament who's seen as having a rising career.
Yes. He's a rising star.
Yeah. Big future ahead of him.
Anointed.
And his loving and devoted wife is played by Cate Blanchett.
Yes. And Australian, but still super British in this movie.
And they're a very loving and devoted couple.
Yes, she's a leader in women's politics, which is a very vague, open-ended subject in the film.
His best friend is kind of a playboy wastrel, played perfectly by Rupert Everett, who was born to play a role like this.
Yes.
He's so perfect.
Charming, but smarmy at the exact same time.
And John Wood is his father, who's not always amused.
Who I saw in a play when I was in England.
I saw him on stage in, Leonard, in...
What was it? Was it Pinter?
In Nicholas Nickleby.
Oh, okay.
He was part of that incredible Royal Shakespeare Company of Nicholas Nickleby that came to
New
America.
York.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that production or him in it and the many other people who were with him. But I digress. Rupert Everett is perfect.
Yeah.
And perfectly cast. And his role, his character turns out to have the most complicated issues or problems as a result of the domino effect of things that go wrong.
Yes, of not following this protocol. The protocol of when the protocol is not to be followed.
Yes. He's a fellow who takes pride in his sloth. Takes pride in his lack of ambition.
Indeed, indeed.
But he turns out to be sort of the center, the vortex of all sorts of
scandal
dealings,
and
double dealings.
Scandal that is set forward, the plot set forward by one of our favorite leading ladies, that is Julianne Moore,
playing British.
Yes. She is American as they come, but so British and really great in this role.
Yes.
As she usually is.
Playing a heartless woman of no conscience.
Yes, will stab you in the back with a smile.
Exactly so. And so it's about all of these machinations and machinations that have to take place within a certain degree of propriety. Mm-hmm. That's part of the amusement here that Oliver Parker takes or derives from Wilde's play. Now, have you seen Wilde's original play? I have.
I haven't seen this original play, no.
So
I've read it, though.
I can't compare. I don't know how freely Parker adapted it.
Yeah, I can't compare as well because it's been a really long time since I've read the play, but it still works. Like I would like to compare the two, but he makes it work. I mean, he made it into a movie.
Yeah.
He wasn't trying to do basically a filmed version of the play. He was trying to make a film in which it's, while still funny and charming, it's still like a film and it's still a plot that he's trying to tell and a story and characters that he's trying to reveal to us. So I think he pulls it off pretty well. And I was surprised because I'm like, oh, the guy that did Hellraiser? Okay.
And there's some sly references to Oscar Wilde, Oscar Wilde's world here and there. In fact, Wilde, the character of Wilde, makes a cameo appearance.
Yes. They're watching The Importance of Being Earnest
curtain
in the
of
play.
A performance of The Importance of Being Earnest, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And there was an earlier version of this, which I must confess I've never seen. It was done in the late 40s, directed by the great British producer-director Alexander Korda, who was a better producer than he was a director, but a very prominent man. And it stars Paulette Goddard, Michael Wilding, Diana Wynyard, the wonderful Glynis Johns. So it's a very good cast. And one of these days I have to try to dig that up and take a look.
Yeah, and it's probably going to have to be dug up.
Yeah, I think
I think it's buried.
Yeah, it hasn't crossed my path, if you know what I mean.
Right, that's how buried it is.
I haven't had a DVD, you know,
if it hasn't crossed your path,
yeah.
That's how you know it's not anywhere.
But if you haven't seen this one, well, you couldn't find, I dare you to find a more attractive cast in anything. This is a gathering of supremely attractive people.
Being very attractive
to each
other. Yes,
being very attractive, and in some cases not so attractive.
Yes.
And as you say, Julianne Moore with that killer smile.
Yes, with the smile. The smile.
A lethal smile.
Yeah, the smile of a snake, if you will. We also have Cate Blanchett, who's always just so wonderful.
And this is her – it's not a part that is meant to showcase her.
Yes.
She kind of disappears into the role. she's not wearing it on her sleeve, so to speak. I just saw her recently in Disney's Cinderella.
Right.
Which, of course, is supposed to be a larger-than-life, outsized performance.
Well, you know, and she tends to get cast as those. I mean, look at – she's Galadriel in Lord of the Rings. She's the Queen of England.
Yeah.
She was an Australian that played Elizabeth.
Yeah.
So she is capable
of
doing – twice, it's true. She's capable of being that larger-than-life, godly, queen-like thing. And in this, she's a very, very, very much smaller.
Yes. She's not a shrinking violet. By any means, but
still a human being.
Yes, yes, and with the good sense of self-worth, and solid character, but her world is shaken by a revelation,
a scandal
that comes her way. We'll say no more than that, and you may know the Oscar Wilde original anyway, so there's not a lot to spoil here. It's the execution, it's the carrying out of this wonderfully. Genteel, witty, and I think still relevant and entertaining piece.
Yeah, and I think that what's one of the things that I think is interesting about it, because we're, you know, since we're talking about leading ladies here, is that the three women in this movie, you know, we've talked about Kate and Julianne, but there's also Minnie Driver, mm-hmm. who is fantastic. There are three very different women,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting to see what. I guess what Wilde thinks that women were at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really interesting representation of just what it meant to be a woman fitting into that very particular world, which wasn't the friendliest for women. But if you knew how to work it, you can make it work for you. And these three women do such in this film.
Yeah, yeah, that's well said. And Lindsay Duncan in a nice supporting role too.
Love her.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. Love Rome. She's done so much more, but I really always enjoy her.
You may have just seen her not long ago in Birdman as that acid-tongued theater critic. I don't like that part, but I like her in it.
She's great.
Yes. So a recommendation from both of us mm-hmm. for an ideal husband with an ideal cast of leading ladies and leading men.
There you go.
And next we're going to go to something not so felicitous. We're going to talk about a leading lady we do like in a film we can't stand.
Yes, felicitous. I will translate that to poopy.
You know what? In this case, I accept that translation. What could we be talking about? You'll find out in just a minute.
Welcome back to Maltin and Movies with Baron Vaughn. I'm Baron Vaughn. Across from me is a man called Leonard Maltin.
That's true.
I speak for him. In that
and at me.
Okay, and at you. Yeah. To you, I hope. Speaking of movies, I'm trying to get some Maltin-esque like segues.
Oh, you're looking for a segue? You're looking for a Henny Youngman segue here?
Speaking of movies that talk at you.
Henny Youngman once told a joke about a movie that was so bad that when they put it on the shelf, the next to it on the shelf moved over.
That's very Youngman.
Yes.
Of course, because he wrote that. We're talking about a movie that we didn't like.
No, didn't like is too
delicate.
Too delicate a phrase. When I saw this in theaters a mere three years ago.
As did I.
I really wanted to walk out. Now, I don't walk out of movies.
I was thinking the same thing, Leonard.
I don't walk out. Partly it's a professional credo.
Yes.
And partly it's, I guess, a streak of masochism. But I don't walk out. And there are times, believe me, when I would like to.
Oh yeah.
But this was one of them.
I don't have to watch as many movies as you do. So it's very rare that I come across a movie where I'm like, I can't stay here for this. And I still stayed. I was like, I gotta see how they finish it at least.
Putrid.
Oof.
What a putrid movie. We're talking about what gets my dander up,
yeah,
folks.
It's getting
I'll tell you what gets
up.
My dander up. A film called Snow White and the Huntsman.
Oof.
And what made me even angrier was it was a hit.
Was it a hit?
Oh, it was a big hit.
Of course.
You know, why we all got into this terrible cycle of redoing, reinventing, recycling, retreading all the fairy tales.
But having to make them super dark and gritty and earthy.
Oh, man. And yet, look, Disney just redid Cinderella straight.
Yeah.
And it was a tremendous success. So I don't buy any of this baloney about how, well, you have to make it edgy now. Or people won't go. You know, it's a new generation and people want their stuff dark and edgy. Yeah, tell that to Cinderella. But tell that to Disney, which is raking in the money from an absolutely straight-ahead rendition of Cinderella.
But you can do edgy and still do it well.
Yes.
Like, it just, like, doing edgy for the sake of edge
yeah.
takes away the edge.
Well, I think so.
And I think that this –
takes away the pleasure.
It takes away the pleasure. And it's a fantasy world, you know, most of the time. Now, look, I like things that are dark. And to be honest, I really did like the production design in this. I mean, that's a big thing that I wanted to see because it looked kind of Del Toro.
Yeah, it's a good-looking movie.
It's a good-looking movie. It just doesn't mean anything in the end. Okay,
why would you do this to the story of Snow White? Why would you want to do this?
They twilighted it. They twilighted it. Is that
no, they did worse than Twilight.
Is that
just because Kristen Stewart is in it?
Who is actually not that bad in it?
No, she's okay.
She's actually one of the better parts.
She's
of
not who I would
movie.
Have cast, but she's okay. I mean, when you talk about some, I mean, beauty is subjective. We all know that, and I admire Kristen Stewart as an actress. She's a good actress. The Twilight films are perhaps her least interesting performances.
Yes, but that's why she's so gigantic.
Yeah. But it's true. It's accrued to her benefit in so many, many ways. But she's a talented actress.
Yeah, I agree.
But when the young Snow White is supposed to have a level of physical beauty that outshines that of her stepmother, played by Charlize Theron, I'm not sure that's the casting choice I would have made.
Okay, so what you're saying is, let me paraphrase, between the two of those women, you think Charlize Theron is the hotter one, in a sense.
Yes, I would say that.
Now,
yes.
And I'm inclined to agree with you on that.
Yeah.
Because, look, I think Kristen Stewart's a very good-looking woman, but it's just like, it's just weird. It's just Charlize Theron looks so immaculate and tall and as Aryan as possible.
Yes, yes.
And then it's just like, there's one person who outshines you, and then you cut to, because it's edgy, a girl who is like her cheeks are sunken in because she's been in a prison and she's as pale as they come because she is Snow White. But it's just kind of like, I don't understand why she's so threatened by this woman.
Oh, please. Because it's that kind of a movie. Because it's that kind of a movie.
Yeah.
And that kind of a movie, by the way, with three screenwriters credited.
Mm.
We don't know if they're the only ones who wrote it. Others may have worked on it. But if you were going to write... One of them gets screen story credit and screenplay credit. His name is Evan Daugherty, kind of a newcomer, who has since written Divergent and the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. All right,
oh,
since this
good
film.
Nice. Right.
One of the other people credited with the screenplay is someone, if you're thinking, well, we want to do a new telling of Snow White. Hey, let's get the guy who wrote Drive.
What?
Sure, let's get the guy who wrote Drive for Nicholas Winding Refn.
Oh, really?
And have him work on Snow White.
That's
Hossein Amini.
Incredible.
That's not to say Hossein Amini isn't a talented writer.
Wow.
And then John Lee Hancock, who is a more traditional filmmaker storyteller, who recently did Saving Mr. Banks. He directed that, didn't write it, but he wrote The Blind Side and directed The Blind Side. You know, that's the kind of guy you'd think you'd hire for a modern Snow White.
What that tells me, and that's fascinating, because this movie is very different things being smashed together in one place.
It looks like they used all of their contributions.
It's not all going to work in one place, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. as if there was nobody saying, well, let's take the best of this and the best of that and the best of that.
And make it one movie.
Make it one movie.
But no, do three movies at the same time in the same place.
You know what? I really feel bad for parents who took their kids to see this, especially younger kids. Because very early in the film, and this is not a spoiler. It happens so early in the film. Not only, of course, in the tradition of the tale of Snow White, not only does Snow White's mother die, but then her stepmother plunges a knife into her father's chest. And we see it.
Very violently and very early in the film.
And then there's close-ups of icky-looking insects and dead birds. There's a whole village of women and children who are cruelly set on fire.
It's edgy. It's edgy, yo.
It's gruesome.
It's, yeah, gruesome. Grim. Grotesque.
Gruesome.
Grotesque.
And the director is a fellow named Rupert Sanders. He's British and apparently has worked mostly in television, does a lot of commercials and things like that. He's not a newcomer, but this is his first feature film. This was his first feature film credit. I can only imagine that his direction to Charlize Theron, a talented actress, was louder. That was good, Charlize, but do it again louder.
You know, and that's Yes, there's very much a lack of direction with how everything fits together. The performance, they try to give – she's just evil.
Yeah.
For no good reason, yeah. Essentially. That's the only thing I can say about this movie is that nothing happens for a good reason. there's no reason to anything that happens. And she just is a lot of crying, a lot of yelling, but yeah. They try to give some sort of like – motivation of why she's so evil, but it doesn't make sense. And then
no shading, no nuance, nothing. No nothing.
But you do hear her South African accent.
Yes. And then just when you think the movie can't get any more grim, and it pretty much can't, they, almost as an afterthought, introduce the Seven Dwarfs. They come in so late in the narrative. It's so lopsided.
Well, it is Snow White and the Huntsman. That's why she spends a lot of time with
exactly,
the Huntsman.
Exactly, right. And the Huntsman is the handsome hunk, Chris Hemsworth. We get that.
Who I don't believe in this movie. Like, it's an interesting thing because I'm like, is that my bias? And I'm like, that's Thor, and Thor's getting beat up. This is like, I didn't buy him as like a lovable screw up, I guess.
Yeah.
Or unlovable screw up. A lot of snarling.
I have
a lot
no
of snarling.
Comment. Yeah. I have no further comment. I just hate this movie, hot heaping hunks of hate. I don't know what more to say.
Yeah, see it if you want to. If you just need some hatred in your heart,
right? Or if you really dislike your children,
don't show it to your children.
No,
it's not for children
at
all.
No, it's not. It's not.
But it's not for anyone.
No, it isn't.
I think they were trying to make it for an 18-year-old who has a lot of emotional problems, but it's like specifically one person.
And I feel bad too because as I say, I do like Charlize Theron. I think she is a talented actress. She's obviously a great beauty, but she's a talented actress. She can do a lot of different things. And I think since she won her Oscar for Monster over a decade ago, mm-hmm. she's tried very hard to find roles that have some meat on their bones. You know, she's trying to find something worthwhile. And she's found it now and then, but not often enough.
I mean,
In the Valley of Ella is a film I like very much that I'd love to talk to you about sometime
yes,
on this
indeed.
Show with Tommy Lee Jones. It's one of her better roles, I think.
I enjoyed her in Young Adult.
Good performance. I didn't love the film.
I said I enjoyed her in Young Adult.
I hear you. And then, what a shame. She decides to do a comedy, and it turns out to be Seth MacFarlane's A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Pew!
Yeah, not a good choice.
The gunshot.
Not a good choice. Really too bad. There she was, willing to do a comedy, ready to do a comedy.
And I think she's actually funny. She might be funny.
Yeah.
But we
yeah.
haven't really gotten to see it yet.
No.
Not since, Devil's Advocate have we seen her comedy chops.
Well, she was on Arrested Development for a little bit.
Okay, all right. But I was being sarcastic.
Yes, I understand. I understand. Well, no, Devil's Advocate is the wrong kind of humor.
Yeah.
Unintended.
Yes, I know.
I know you know. I hope you know that I know that you know.
So, Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yes.
It stinks.
Yeah. Or as Mel Brooks would say, it stinks on ice.
Yes, there you go.
Goodness gracious, what a movie. But we got a better one for you.
Hey.
We're going to end on a high note, folks, because we got a good one. Our sleeper this week is a honey, and we'll be right back to tell you about it. Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. I am Leonard Maltin.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I'm Baron Vaughn, and I was going to be very confused.
No.
I'm going to be like, if you're Baron Vaughn, then who am I? Head explode.
No, we don't want to confuse anybody.
Okay.
Life is confusing enough.
It's sort of.
I'll tell you what's not confusing.
What's not confusing, Leonard?
What's not confusing, Baron, is identifying a really fine movie.
Yes, indeed.
We know it when we see it, and in this case, its name is Passion Fish.
Passion Fish, written and directed by the great John Sayles.
Indeed.
Who we talked about recently when we spoke about Brother from Another Planet.
Mm-hmm.
Passion Fish, John Sayles.
Wow. Another film that I haven't seen in a long time. Came out in 1992. I liked it enormously then. And watching it last week, I said, this is just as good as I remember.
Yes.
Every bit as good as I remember. It stars Mary McDonnell and Alfre Woodard.
Two fantastic, electric actors, if you want to use the gender-neutral term, mm-hmm, it is, mm-hmm, who their chemistry in this movie is just beautiful.
It's perfect. It's perfect because you believe them.
Mm-hmm.
You believe them individually and you believe their relationship. And
what they get from each other.
Yes.
And how they grow.
There's nothing simplistic about this movie.
Mm-mm.
It's a film that is made by adults for adults, you might say.
Yes, if you are an adult – and you want to see something that's grown? Here you go, Passion Fish.
Boy, Mary McDonnell got an Oscar nomination for this.
Oh, she did?
Yes, she did, and well-deserved. She had, you know, she was mainly a stage actress and had a later start in movies than many of her colleagues might have. But she came to our attention, our collective attention, in Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves.
Right.
She made such an impression in that movie that she got an Oscar nomination for that. And this was made just 2 years later. So it's early in her career. More recently, of course, people know her from television because she was on ER, got an Emmy nomination for that. She was on Battlestar Galactica for 5 years, and then The Closer for several years, and now the sort of the sequel, the spinoff of The Closer called Major Crimes. Mm. So she's been a familiar face on television for quite a long time.
She's a force.
But she's really good, really solid. And in this film, when we first meet her at the very beginning of the film, she's in a hospital bed, and she is the worst, nastiest patient you've ever seen.
Yes.
Just dripping with sarcasm, not an ounce of gratitude for the care she's getting.
She looks like she's staring through you.
Just a miserable, miserable human being named Mae Alice, a soap opera actress, a soap opera star, really, who's had a terrible accident. Terrible vehicle accident, and in New York City, is miserable, miserable beyond words. And so she has decided to return to her
childhood home.
Her childhood home in Louisiana. The house in which she grew up, I guess, right?
Yeah. She says she has a house there, so she gets sent down there after a very long and grueling, and it's the information is great at the beginning of this movie, just how they kind of get into her having been in this accident, her in the hospital, how evil she is to everyone. After all of that, she shows up at this house and is carried to her door by a very large Russian nurse who is complaining about there being no ramp, rightfully so.
Right, exactly so. And then she has her first session with a physical therapist down in Louisiana, played by Maggie Renzi, John Sayles' significant other and longtime producer, and a very good actress too.
Yes, who was also in Brother from Another Planet.
Yep. And so she goes to a succession of caregivers, no surprise, because she's just so miserable.
Mm-hmm.
She's a miserable person, and she has no empathy, no sympathy. No sympathy, she has nothing to give
There's no pathy. Right. All the pathies are gone.
Until Alfre Woodard shows up.
Enter Alfre Woodard, one of my favorites.
A woman who has her own backstory that we won't reveal, but really needs this job.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason she puts up with McDonald's verbal abuse, which is plentiful, is that she needs this job.
Mm-hmm.
Except at a certain point, and not too far along the road, she starts talking back.
Right. And essentially, you know, because she doesn't like being disrespected.
Yep.
And there's a lot of disrespect coming from Mae Alice, Mary's character.
Mm-hmm.
So she gives it back as good as she gets, and it starts to change the dynamic of the relationship because this woman will not be bullied. She will not be bullied.
So if this was a simplistic Hollywood movie, you'd describe it as they start off as antagonists and they wind up as friends.
Yeah.
But it's not a simplistic movie, and it doesn't happen quite as simply or easily as all that. That is kind of the path that follows. I mean, it's not a secret giving that away. But it's the deepening
mm-hmm.
and the layering of that relationship that makes this film what it is.
And so unique. You know, it's not – there's nothing easy about this film.
No,
and
no.
Every scene is surprising mm-hmm. and just grows this this beautiful plant.
Yeah. And as you were observing when we were off mic,
yeah.
There are no throwaway roles in John Sayles' movies.
Oh, every person's a human in all of his movies. As you know, sometimes you see a role and it has no name. It's just a description of the character. But every person that you meet in this film is a human, 100%, and came from somewhere and is going somewhere. And there's a great supporting cast in this film. We got Vondi Curtis Hall,
mm-hmm.
Tom Wright, who was also Brother from Another Planet. He's worked with John Sayles a bunch of different times.
The wonderful David Strathairn.
Yes.
Who was a John Sayles regular as well.
One of his – he's got a repertory company that I'm fine with him having.
And then an actress whose name I had to look up because I didn't know it, who has Angela Bassett, Vondi Curtis yes. Hall's real-life wife.
At the time.
At the time. But also an actress named Nancy Metee, M-E-T-E-E. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. She plays one of Mary McDonald's soap opera co-stars who comes to visit one day.
Yes.
They're on a junket, and they come to pay their respects to her in Louisiana.
Angela Bassett is another one of right. the soap opera stars.
And this young actress embarks on what can only be called a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
If this was a stage piece, you'd say, oh, well, there's her monologue.
The lights would go down and focus on
yes,
her, and
yes.
every audience would just be riveted.
You can picture it.
Yeah.
You can picture it, absolutely. But it's great.
In this film, it's a hell of a speech.
It sure is.
And it's like out of – you want to say it's out of nowhere, but it's not out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It fits perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. It shouldn't. It shouldn't, really. It's the kind of speech that we should be saying right now, well, it's a nice speech, but it doesn't really belong in this movie.
But it does.
It does. It's just fine. I wrote down one exchange I like, one little simple dialogue exchange.
Yeah.
At one point, Mary McDonald says, I kind of gross you out, don't I? Alfred Woodard says, is this a trick question? That's a sample of the back and forth.
His dialogue, man. John
Sayles.
He
writes the best dialogue.
Oof.
I think he's incapable of writing a false line of dialogue. I may have said that when we discussed Brother from Another Planet, but it's one of the things I admire most about him in his movie writing and in his literature as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's just got a great ear, an incredible ear, a very, very rare commodity, a very rare asset.
Yes, indeed.
Also, this was photographed by the great Roger Deakins.
Yes, which I noticed that at the beginning, one of the great cinematographers.
Yes, and there's a wonderful scene at night on the bayou.
Oh, yeah, on the boat.
Yeah.
David Strathairn takes them out on his boat, and they're coming back. The boat breaks, something happens, and they're out at night, and he drives them back, and it's just, it's a love letter.
Yeah.
A visual love letter to the bayou at that time.
It sure is. Gosh. Again, can't say enough about it. Passion Fish, a great American film. Just no two ways about it. A great American film with two outstanding – well, all the performances are really good,
mm-hmm.
but it's a great showcase for both Mary McDonald and the wonderful Alfre Woodard.
Yeah, Alfre's been around for a long time.
She got her first Oscar nomination a decade earlier for Cross Creek back mm-hmm. in 1983, and she's never stopped working. I looked this up. She has had 17 Emmy nominations.
Ooh.
17!
Yes, that's a lot.
And she won – four, I think. One for Hill Street Blues, for L.A. Law, for Miss Evers' Boys, for The Practice.
Ooh, Miss Evers' Boys is a heck of a movie. Heck of a movie.
Gosh.
And a great
then Steel Magnolias, the recent remake of Steel Magnolias.
Yes.
And right now she's on that TV series State of Affairs playing the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a certain bearing.
A gravitas.
To play the President of the United States, regardless of gender.
Yes.
And she's got it.
Yes, she does. Down in the Delta, which is a great – it was a great little movie that Maya Angelou made, which she's in. And then Miss Firecracker Contest, which – look, I know Alfre. She's a friend. She told me that's one of her favorite roles that she's ever done.
Yeah.
So she looked all of those movies up.
Well, if we ever do a show and feature her, there's mm-hmm. a little film she made called What's Cooking I like very much.
Okay. And then we could put Crooklyn next to it.
We can do it all sorts
of
things.
And then we could – anything with C's and O's.
Yeah, right. Try and stop us. You can't. So those are our three films du jour or du semaine and
– Déjeuner? Nope.
Two of them we recommend. An Ideal Husband. Someone wrote to us and said, say the names again. All right.
Yes.
So I will. An Ideal Husband. Yes.
Yes.
Passion Fish. Yes, yes, yes. And Snow White and the Huntsman, no.
All these movies are good. Clearly, Passion Fish is our favorite.
Yeah.
of the three.
It is. It is. And with good reason.
Yeah. Wait, I say all these movies are good. I'm sorry. Ideal Husband and Passion Fish are good.
To be very clear.
Snow White
I think
and
we
the
were
Huntsman
clear, but just
is
to be
good
very
and
clear.
Terrible.
Yeah. Those are the movies, folks. And we'll see you next week with more of that. But we have a bonus. We have a surprise for you.
Yes, we have a guest that we did an interview with, a wonderful actor named
Stephen Tobolowsky.
Yes, and so we're going to drop that on Friday.
I think so. We're going to do a bonus episode.
A bonus-ode.
It's a lovely interview with a wonderful man. If you're not a fan of the Tobolowsky Files, his great podcast, or his book Dangerous Animals Club, or his work in untold scores of movies and television shows, you ought to be. And if you listen to this interview, I think you'll become a fan.
Yes, indeed.
He's a charmer and a great, great storyteller. So please give it a try. It's a bonus episode we think you'll enjoy.
Pop.
Pop?
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.